The very dramatic first aliyah of Parshas Toldos begins with the word that gives the Parsha its name and also sets the tone for much of which we will read about. Ve'ela Toldos Yitzchak, these are the Toldos, a word which can be translated a number of ways. Literally, it seems to mean these are the descendants of Yitzchak, but it can also be read as this is the story of the life of Yitzchak. And those two themes are interconnected in the Parsha. We indeed read about the descendants of Yitzchak, but we also read about the legacy of Yitzchak and how the sons of Yitzchak define his legacy. And legacy is a theme that this pasuk continues to speak about. We are told after Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram holidus Yitzchak, seemingly repetitive, and some commentaries suggest that the message is that Yitzchak followed in the path of Avram, carried on the mission and the legacy of Avram, and that question of who indeed would carry on his mission and his legacy among his descendants is one of the major themes of this Aliyah and the Parsha. So the Aliyah tells us that Yitzchak and Rivka at first struggle having children, and they pray to God in order to have that situation resolved, and their prayers are answered, and they end up having twins. And these twins are prophesied to be the ancestors of different nations, and indeed, they grow up to be very different people. And the Torah tells us, "Ve'yigdulu hana'arim, v'hi Esav ish yodei etzayid ish sodeh," that Esav was a hunter and a person of that nature. "V'yakov ish tam yoshev ohalim," while Yaakov, his brother, is much milder and one who sits in tents, of a very different personality. And the difference between them was actually the subject of a strong criticism leveled against the parenting of Yitzchak and Rivka by Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch suggests, among other points that he raises, that the source of some of their problems was the fact that despite the differences between Yaakov and Esav, they were given the same chinuch, they were given the same education, and that goes against the wisdom of the pasuk, chanoch l'nar al pi darko, that different personalities, different inclinations require different styles and different approaches. However, it's also possible to suggest perhaps a little differently. It's noteworthy the way the pasuk highlights the next pasuk over here, V'yahav Yitzchak es Esav ki tzayid b'fiv, v'rivko heves es Yaakov. The Torah tells us that each parent had their favorite, so to speak, that while Rivka loved Yaakov, which is understandable given his righteous personality, Yitzchak loved Esav because tzayid b'fiv, apparently because of his adeptness at hunting. And it's a pasuk that's hard to understand. It makes it seem as if Yitzchak was susceptible to being won over by bribery, so to speak, by what Esav was able to provide for him. And presumably there's much more to it, and indeed this is a topic that's going to come up later in the Parsha, and there are those who suggest that it was far more complicated than that. The Rosh Yeshiva of Karen Biavna, Rav Goldwicht, and also the Mashkiach, Rav Rivlin, both of them in their Svarim, note that the difference between Yaakov and Esav, as per Yitzchak's perception, wasn't so much that Yitzchak was understanding Esav to be completely materialistic and devoted to hunting, while Yaakov was a spiritual one, but rather Yitzchak saw Yaakov as spiritual only, and Esav as having more of an ability to bring together the spiritual and material worlds, and thought that therefore he would be more suited to carry on the legacy and to address the world as such. And while there was a flaw in that perception, but it wasn't necessarily as blatant as one might understand from the initial reading of the psukim. But it's also worth noting that perhaps one could suggest that maybe if there was a need to correct Esav's behavior, that perhaps the language of Ve'ahav Yitzchak es Esav, so that suggests a more active kind of love, not necessarily a instinctive reaction, that the rest of the pasuk tells us for Rivka, Heves es Yaakov, that's an ongoing kind of thing, that's how Rivka felt about Yaakov, but Yitzchak's reaction and Yitzchak's treatment of Esav seems like a more deliberate phrasing, that Yitzchak chose to love Esav, recognizing that he had this more materialistic bent. And perhaps the idea was that he saw a need to give him more attention in order to guide his growth and in order to make sure that the spiritual part of his personality would come out, and that this materialistic bent would indeed be merged with a spiritual tendency, and that he would be able to bring the two together in a positive direction. So if that's the case, so that goes in a very different way than Rav Hirsch's interpretation, and indeed suggests that there were different attitudes towards the parenting, and it's not so much that Yitzchak was taken in by Esav, but Yitzchak saw a need to treat Esav differently because of his tendencies and his inclinations, and had to try to direct his behavior in a way that would be more productive and do more for his legacy than otherwise would have been. And in any event, they certainly are very different. And the Torah describes to us that fateful day when it was actually the funeral of Avram, as Chazal tell us, and Yaakov was cooking food, and Esav came in, and he was very hungry, he was very tired, he was ayef, and Esav says to Yaakov that he needs some of this food, this red stuff, ha-adom hazeh, ha-adom ha-adom hazeh, ki ayef anochi, because I am about to faint, I am famished, and Yaakov says, I'm only going to give it to you if you sell me the bechora. So this notion of the sale of the birthright, which has such a major impact on everything that happens afterwards, is itself a fascinating topic, and a topic that requires much explanation. And indeed, there is much discussion about it, both from a technical and a moral perspective. From a technical perspective, the question has to be asked, first of all, what is it that Yaakov was trying to purchase, and how was he able to purchase it? Rashi understands over here that Yaakov was trying to purchase the ability to serve as the avoda, that the bechor would be the one at that point in history who would perform the avoda, and Yaakov understood that Esav was not worthy for that, and therefore he wanted to acquire that right from him. While other Rishonim understood differently, that the idea was the Bechor in its sense of monetary privilege, and the way the Rashbam and the Tur and the Rivash and his Chuvas understand that Yaakov was trying to acquire the monetary rights that come with being the Bechor. And what it was that he was trying to acquire, so that affects another issue, a technical issue of just how is it that one can purchase a birthright? How is it that that is something that can be bought or sold? It seems to be something that is intangible, and whatever benefits that it brings about seem to be in the future, what we call a davar shaloba la'olam. And indeed, this is an issue that many of the Mefarshim bring up, that it would seem that this is a sale on a davar shaloba la'olam, on something that does not yet exist. And that being the case, so how is that something that can be subject to a sale? So this is an issue a number of Mefarshim raise, and a number of Mefarshim discuss. And one approach is to focus on the language of Yaakov, as the Panim Yafos notes, the Yomer Yaakov Michrocha Yom, sell it to me today, that perhaps creating the purchase as effective from this moment on is what enabled it to be a sale that was valid, despite the fact that there were aspects of it that would only kick in later. And in the Panim Yafos' understanding, it was actually the avoda then that's being transferred now, and the Yerusha rights that would come later, the inheritance rights that would come later, are able then to flow from that. While others understand in an opposite way, the Torah, for example, focuses on the fact that it's really the Yerusha, the monetary aspect, that could be susceptible to a sale because of its monetary component. And maybe it's the Shvuah that is involved here that allows this to function, despite the fact that it otherwise would have this issue of referring to something that has not yet come into the world. So this is a topic that Rishonim and the later Svarim try to understand, and there are many contemporary Svarim that talk about these issues at great length. Rav Asher Weiss and the Sefer Minchas Asher, many other contemporary Svarim take up this issue, and they point out that the issue of whether a Shavua should help may have to do with the question of what exactly is the impediment. When you say that a sale can't take place with something that is lo bala olam, something that does not yet exist, is the issue perhaps that there's a lack of seriousness, that we can't expect someone to really focus on that which is not yet here, in which case maybe a Shavua would display seriousness, and that would perhaps counteract that problem? Or is it simply that when it comes to transactions need to have something real and present, and the absence of that is not necessarily going to be fixed by a shvua? There are other suggestions that perhaps the method of transaction was helpful here. The Sforno understands that the food that was being used served as an object of chalipin, as a specific type of kinyan of a barter that perhaps can overcome these impediments. Some point out also that this may be instance of situmta. Situmta is a type of kinyan that reflects the minig, that reflects the local custom. Maharam Rutenberg writes in his Chuvis that in those days, it was the policy, it was the custom to seal a deal with food and drink, and therefore that perhaps could serve as a kinyan that is powerful enough even to overcome the problem of dealing with something that doesn't yet exist. So these are among the many, many approaches. There's a quite extensive literature about this, addressing this and other issues that technically seem to pose problems to the effectiveness of the kinyan. Rav Asher Weiss has many, many essays about this in the expanded version of his Sefer Allah Torah that came out recently, and he notes also the fundamental problem of separating aside from the many questions of how the transaction itself worked, but the birthright itself wouldn't seem to be something that can be transferred, wouldn't seem to be something that can be bought and sold. And he suggests, based on earlier sources, that the brachos to which Yaakov became entitled through this purchase actually pushed Esav out of his status as being an official descendant of Yitzchak, and therefore that automatically gave Yaakov the status of the birthright, and perhaps that was how it functioned. But there is, of course, also a moral issue to consider here, because it would seem as if Yaakov exploited Esav, and he took advantage of the fact that Esav was famished and felt, at least in his mind, that he was going to die. And that would seem to raise the question of, was this an exploitative transaction? And was this a violation of what we call onah? That if one conducts a transaction at a price that is overly favorable to himself and not fair to the other party, whether he pays too little or charges too much, so that is a Torah prohibition known as onah, which is sometimes translated as price fraud. So this was a topic that was discussed by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, Zichrono Levracha, who was a great economist in addition to being a great Talmud Chacham. And he noted that as far as the appropriate price here, so this is an example of what could be known as a bilateral monopoly, that essentially it's a monopoly in two directions, because you don't have any objective market here. There's only one person in the world who is able to sell this birthright. Esav is the only one who can sell it. He has a monopoly in that sense. There's no competition. And there's only one person in the world who would be interested in buying it, and that's Yaakov. So it's also a monopoly from that perspective. So there's no competition on either side. So there's no way to establish the objective value of this item other than that which the two parties are ready to pay or to be paid, and how it reflects the perception each one has of their leverage in the situation. So there isn't necessarily an objective price that one could deviate from that would constitute onah, but one could still wonder, is there perhaps a waiting game that was being played here that Yaakov was trying to exploit Esav's desperation? So to that, Rabbi Levine explains that, first of all, one potential defense to that could be that we see that the Torah says that Esav didn't value the Bechara at all. So really, the question could go in the other direction. Given that Yaakov did value it and Esav didn't, there was the possibility of Esav exploiting him. And perhaps Yaakov was just trying to level the playing field and make sure that he wouldn't become the victim of Esav's exploitation. But Rabbi Levine feels that even that was more than Yaakov in his honesty and integrity would have done. And he suggests that actually there was a different reason for waiting to this point. And that was that it was only at this point that it became clear that through Esav's attitude and his declarations, where he says that here I'm going to die, hine anochi holech lamus v'lama zeh li b'chora, that he didn't put any value in this spiritual legacy. So Yaakov then recognized that Esav was an unworthy bearer of the legacy of Avram. And it was only specifically then that he had to take action and make his move in order to rescue it and to redeem it. And even though we are told that already 2 years before, when they became bar mitzvah, so Esav's reputation had already become clear, but because the Gemara in Makos emphasizes, based on the pasuk, that Yaakov was such a tzaddik that he was careful in Hilchos Lashon Hara, so he wouldn't have accepted secondhand information. So the fact that others were saying bad things about Yaakov, about Esav, so Yaakov wasn't ready to believe that, he wouldn't have listened to that. But now that he saw himself firsthand just how much Esav was disdainful of the spiritual legacy that came along with the birthright, so then Yaakov realized that at that moment he had to take action and he had to rescue the birthright for the sake of the future. And that was the action that indeed he did, and that has great consequences, as the rest of the parsha will tell us. And before we close out this aliyah, we transition into Perek Chavav, and the Torah tells us that there is a famine, but Yitzchak is told nonetheless he should stay in Eretz Yisrael, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises him great brachos as a consequence of his following in the path of Avram and as a descendant of Avram. And the Torah has the phrase here, Eikav Asher Shama Avraham Bikoli. And this is a factor of that Avram listened to my voice, Vayishmor Mishmarti Mitzvosai Chukosai Vesorosai. And Chazal have an attitude here, the Gemara Maseches Yuma, Daf Chav Chesed Mitbeis, and elsewhere, that this represents the fact that Avram and others, Avram and the Avos, but especially Avram, kept the entire Torah before it was given, even Erev Tashil, and even halachos that are not in the Torah itself, but are dinim midrabanan. And that idea of the notion of the Avos keeping the Torah, a fascinating concept, which is the source of many discussions and many analyses of the psukim, specifically in Sefer Bereishis. But the idea that he could, and Yitzchak and Yaakov could keep the Torah before it was given, what exactly the parameters are, what does it apply to, that's the subject of much discussion. But how is it even possible in the first place? So the Rashba and others understand that because the Avos were so in tune with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's values, and they were able to become sensitized to the Ratzon HaBorei, to that which God wants, so they were able to therefore intuit what would later be commanded in the Torah. And they were able to figure out what those mitzvos would ask of us. And therefore, it also makes sense that even the Dinim Derabanan that the Gemara talks about, Erev Tavshilin, which themselves some understand are a result of Chazal being able to understand the Ratzon HaTorah beyond that which is spelled out in the Torah. So here the Avos were able to do this all together, to figure out that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu would later command in the Torah, and that which Chazal would later command beyond that which is written in the Torah, all as a result of their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's value system and their appreciation for the Ratzon HaBorei. So this notion of the Avos upholding the values of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the important concern here that respect for this value system be passed on through the generations, through the generations to their descendants, is of course the crucial theme that sets the tone for so much of what we will read in the rest of this very dramatic parsha.